Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Anybody who's been watching the news, reading the paper, who is here on Morgan State University's campus knows there's been a controversy brewing over with the student government here on campus and the school newspaper over articles that were printed earlier in the year, over issues raised in those articles about the power of student government and where they think the money should be spent here at the university. And it is much of the major media has covered it, and we were approached by students here at the university to come on the air to talk about it. Morgan State University owns the license here to the station and clearly wants to see the conversation take place and have a conversation open here at the university. So people are here in the studios with us. Ryan Marshall is with us, who's contributing writer for The Spokesman, which is the newspaper here on campus. He's sports editor of the yearbook, producer of The Spokesman Insider TV show. Melissa Longley is with us, who is the Student Association President. We're also joined by Jasmine T. Curry. Jasmine Curry is Student Government Association Vice President. And Kevin Smith. Kevin J. Smith is Editor-in-Chief of The Spokesman. And folks, welcome. Good to have you all here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
The university declined. The people who are in charge of that, the Vice Presidents, are not here and present in this conversation. Clint Coleman and I, who's Morgan State University Public Relations official, have been talking. He's headed towards a meeting in Washington. If he can join us by phone, he will. But he and I have talked a number of times leading up to this conversation, and is well aware of it, and I hope he can participate, and so does he. Number here is 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. 410-319-8888. So where do we start? We start with Ryan Marshall, or should we start with the president of the association to talk? Ryan, why don't you begin?
Okay.
Just to talk about why there is so much going on around the issue of the publication of the paper and the anger from the Student Government Association here on campus. I've read all the articles, at least the ones that I found on The Spokesman, and I get The Spokesman by email, so why don't you start us off?
Well, once again, I just want to say thank you for
having me
and having us on the show. I think this started out, and I think you're well aware, that this started out as five articles, three of them which were editorial, and the other two were straight news pieces in The Spokesman newspaper that addressed issues of the Office of Student Activities, whether or not they have more control than they should have over SGA, different things like budgetary issues, things like that. The university wrote a letter to The Spokesman newspaper stating that they wanted to meet with the students individually to talk about the issues at hand that, mm-hmm. and their evidence mm-hmm. that they had brought. And so Ms. Denise Brown, who is no longer employed with the university, former advisor of The Spokesman, stated that in an email that, yes, we can meet with you, but I would prefer to have the editor-in-chief, myself as the advisor, another former advisor, and the reporters of those stories all meet together to be able to speak.
You requested this?
No, Ms. Brown did.
Ms. Brown, okay, right.
When the university administration approached Ms. Brown by way of memorandum.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for whatever reason, that never took place. And so months later, this was back in February 19th to be exact. June 11th comes up a letter from the Office of Student Activities in the University Administration stating that, hey, listen, you never adhere to our original request until that original request for these reporters takes place. Your contract will not be renewed. And this was all in a memorandum from University Administration. Ms. Brown tried to rectify and say, hey, listen, you know, I can't ask these students to meet with you. One, they are out of town because of summer break. It's June. And two, even if I wanted to force them to do this, which I cannot force these kids to do this, you know, they're out of town. So a letter came. There was no real official discourse or dialogue between the two sides. Letter stating, hey, thank you very much for your services. You've been a big help to this university, but we will not be rehiring you.
Now, I'm really interested in beyond that, because I don't know much about that case except what I've read in the paper, and clearly the university is saying it's a personal issue. They're not going to talk about it.
Well, they already did. So, I mean, they made it public in the Baltimore Sun. So,
right. But what I'm saying is that clearly people are not going to talk about her specific case. We've called her up. She was not available to come on today. And so we did talk to her on the phone. Sure. So what I'd like to kind of explore, though, for a minute with the four of you is what the issues are. I mean, what I was really kind of what the issues are here on campus that just beyond the personnel issue, but beyond the Denise Brown issue at the moment, what are the things that are kind of sitting in your craw that are creating this angst on campus? I think I read one piece. I don't know who wrote it. I don't remember the author of the piece, but one of the pieces had to do with, I find The Diary of a Leading Lady a really interesting piece. That and we can talk about that in a minute.
Well, that doesn't have much to do with student government.
It doesn't, but it had a sense of the conflict got to me from that piece. I'm going to talk about that. But one of the things that was in here was that it was an article about the loss of power of student government on this campus. Mm-hmm. And in the article, you all alluded to, whoever wrote the article alluded to, how the student government back in the 60s was a significant organization. And I knew a lot of those people back then, because I'm that old. people like Skip Logan and others who led the demonstrations when we all demonstrated at Northwood Shopping Center to integrate Northwood Shopping Center. And that was led in large part by student government leaders here at Morgan State, then college. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to start there. I mean, talk about what you see as the diminution of power that you say exists from student government here from times before. Either one of you all, or both actually, Melissa and Jasmine.
Well, I'll start.
Melissa is president. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, it all depends. You know, every year a new president comes in.
For the student government.
For the student government. Right. It's a year position. What you're willing to do with it, is what will come about. So not saying that the past two presidents or the past three or five have not done their job, but power comes within and also with your board. If you don't show respect to your board and you can't have an alliance with them,
then who is your board? Just for my edification.
Okay, well, your board is your Mr. and Ms. Morgan, all class presidents, vice presidents, and then you also have your cabin, which is like your PR manager, business manager, comptroller.
Are they elected?
Those positions are appointed by myself and Jasmine. Elected positions are president, vice president, and Mr. and Ms. Morgan. Those are elected.
Okay.
So if you really can't get your board on one accord, or you all don't have the same passion, the same goal, then the power would be lost. It will be. But some people get into these positions for resume fillers. So I think that's why in the past years that the power has been lost. And also, we don't really utilize our resources. You know, student government is a self-governing institution, and it's a self-governing organization. We control what goes on with our own budget and what events that we put out and what we expect on the campus. So if we don't take control of it, then the power is lost.
And when Jasmine. the power is lost, a lot of times. With that article in particular, Melissa and I, we weren't in office yet. And there were questions that were being raised regarding our budget, where certain monies were
before
going.
Before you took office?
Before we
took
office.
Is that why you ran?
That had a lot to do with it, yes.
Uh-huh.
But because there were so many questions, that's why different reporters from the Spokesman newspaper began to come within the SGA office and ask questions. And because especially SGA members like Melissa and myself, we are very transparent, we are very open. We will tell you, you know, there are some questions, we're working on it. But because, you know, the president and vice president, maybe at the time, they didn't feel as though it was a pressing issue. They just let a lot of things go and swept a lot of stuff under the rug, unfortunately. But as president and vice president, Melissa and I, we just have to, you have to make sure you have a strong comptroller to account for all of the funds.
This is a student you're talking about?
Yes, this is a student. Right. This is a student. They have to make sure that all the budgets that we approve, that the class presidents and vice presidents are adhering to what we approve to them. So it's all a matter of checks and balances within the student government. Now, I will admit that there, like Melissa said, we have lost our power as student government president and vice president in past years. But I really think it's all up to individual administrations, and we're ready to reclaim our campus culture and community, which is what we ran on. So, I mean, we're ready to take that power back.
I'm going to try to hear from it. I'm going to come back and I'm trying to remember what you just said, because I'd like to know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
When you say you want to reclaim, how did you put it in? You want to reclaim?
Reclaim our campus culture and community.
Oh, now, I want to explore that.
Okay.
All right, let me turn for a second over to Kevin Smith, who's editor-in-chief of The Spokesman. So talk about your perspective on this as editor-in-chief and the articles you wrote and what happened there.
Well, I think one of the main things that is really the issue here is the fact that, you know, we felt more like we were being censured or basically from the administration told what we can and cannot write as individuals.
Now, how did that work? Did they come in and say you can't write this article?
I mean, basically by them, in journalism, there is a right that we have as journalists where we are not required to give up our sources. And basically, we felt by them coming in and saying, you know, well, we're going to force you into a meeting individually with those people or those students that wrote those articles to give you give up our sources. We felt it as looked at it as a form of intimidation.
Well, let me just stop for a second. I want to be clear and have some clarity about what you're talking about. Let me slide that mic just a tad away from your mouth there. So that's cool. All right. So you're saying articles were written. Some of the articles that are in this folder, What's Done in the Dark, Must Come to Light, Brownata, MSU's Newspaper Advisor, other things like that, that there were articles that you wrote or people wrote in your newspaper that you're editor-in-chief of that were challenged by the university and they were going to call you in individually to talk about those things?
They were going to call the writers in individually and talk to the writers individually. And basically it was then agreed upon to my understanding that they would meet together but not separately. And then for whatever reason, they decided not to meet at all. And that's we basically feel as students that that's where our rights were violated in the fact that they wanted us to come forth or those writers to come forth and produce their sources.
And you mean you were asked specifically to produce your sources?
Yes, these were in letters that were written from the administration and paraphrasing, not quoting directly, but they basically said that these accusations are baseless. We want you to produce these sources that you had that you
right.
wrote about.
Right.
And so, you know, with that, when we decided not to meet individually, but as a group, then there was no dialogue or discourse for that amount of time. And then June 11th, produce the students or you don't get your job back or you don't get your contract renewed. And then we feel like that is after, you know, you tell the advisor of the spokesman and student media that you need to do this or your contract is not going to be renewed, and then actually not renew her contract and remove her in lieu of somebody from that office. The person that is currently serving as interim advisor is the assistant to her boss. She's an assistant coordinator in the Office of Student Activities who's currently now serving as interim advisor. That has very strong implications of censorship.
We're talking with students here at Morgan State University, student government officials, Melissa Longley and Jasmine Curry, and who make the argument that student government's power has been diminished and they want to reclaim it. We're exploring that. Editor-in-Chief Kevin Smith of The Spokesman, which is the newspaper here at Morgan State University, saying that they've been challenged and their articles have been challenged, and he thinks that it's diminishing their right of speech on campus. And Ryan Marshall works both in the Yearbook and The Spokesman and on their Insider TV show, who is voicing those concerns as a whole here. The number here is 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Bringing your thoughts to the airwaves. I know the campus is not buzzing with activity now, but there are students here and faculties here, and we'd love to hear your thoughts, people's thoughts just about the power of student government and the power of press on campuses and your thoughts about that. A lot of Morgan State alumni listen. So join us here, 410-319-8888. But you don't have to be part of Morgan to do this. You can. Every university faces issues like this. And what are your thoughts on it? 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook, the Mark Steiner Show page, and we'll look at, see what you're writing in there and hear what your thoughts are, 410-319-8888. So in the best of all possible worlds, what do you all want to see happen? I mean, if you know, as kind of an old veteran of my own campus politics back a long time ago, when we were a little more bottled even, maybe. What is it that you want to see? I mean, when you talked about a little bit ago, Jasmine Curry, about your campaign slogan, what you wanted to see, what does that mean? I mean, what is it you all want that doesn't exist?
It means a lot. A lot falls under reclaiming our campus culture and community.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Well, campus, for example, in Melissa and I's speech, when we ran, we asked
ran
the question.
Yeah,
we ran as a ticket. We ran on one ticket. Mm-hmm. We asked the question, where is the B in HBCU? Because we feel as though a lot of students, not only do they not know Morgan's history and the legacy that Morgan has, they also don't know much about their culture, which also ties into reclaiming our culture. So just making students aware of Black history, of the history of Morgan, and the rich legacy that we all come from and that we're all a part of now. Community, Melissa and I found, just with campaigning and talking to students and people within the community, we found that the community has lost a lot of respect for Morgan students. And that's because Morgan students, we don't really respect the community that we are now a part of. So we just wanted to get Morgan students out into the community so that we're not always receiving just the negative press about, you know, the bad things that may occur on or around campus, but also get media attention to the positive things that are happening. And yesterday, Melissa and I, we actually sat with members from Shepherd, from the library.
Enoch Pratt.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Shepherd Pratt, not Shepherd Pratt. Enoch Pratt. The library personnel, and we're starting a program called Read Across Baltimore. We're going into the libraries around the city and reading to the students. So it's just little things like that. We're just trying to get the community back on our side, educate students on our culture, and just get the campus on one accord, because at the end of the day, this campus belongs to the students and not to any administration.
And why we reclaim it is because it is ours. Mm-hmm. We just need to realize that it's ours. Mm-hmm. This is our campus. We are African Americans. Some people might be Caucasian, but it's still our culture. Mm-hmm. And this is our community. We realize that you might tend to hear for 4 or 5 years, but this is our community. You might be from New Jersey. You might be from D.C., but right now you live in Baltimore, so we need to help Baltimore out.
A lot of people calling us. I want to get to the phones here. And Larry, Zana, and Ron, we're going to come right to your calls. But I want to kind of... I want to get a sense, a real kind of concrete sense of what it is the students are demanding very specifically that you're looking for that doesn't exist.
Basically, what we want, I think, is one...
Kevin Smith.
And what's being done here today by us being here and the SGA being here is for the SGA to band with other organizations like the Spokesman. And I think that's something in previous administrations we have not had. It seems like the SGA and the Spokesman are just in two totally separate worlds or areas, and we don't really come together. And I think it's also a matter of not just us coming together with the SGA, but students really knowing that, you know, we can come together. And I think the bigger issue here at hand, along with the censorship, is also not even so much the dealing with Ms. Brown and the personnel issues, but there are true budget issues here that have been revealed. You know, many colleges that I know in the area, and in fact across the United States, the SGA president and vice president, and usually the managing editor and editor in chief of the newspaper and the yearbook, are usually paid at least a stipend in their positions for every semester or every year. And we're not getting paid, and yet here we are in a position where we have a budget that we don't even know what the budget is. You know, they can say that it costs $18,000 a year to print the Spokesman or to print the Promethean, but beyond that, we don't know what we have in surplus, when in fact, we probably have enough in surplus to not only pay the positions, but then to also take care of new equipment that we need. And I'll say this, and then I'll let you
go on.
It's like, basically, you know, there are new levels of journalism out there in the world that when we graduate, you know, we'll have to experience. There's new types of high-tech software,
right,
new types of computers,
right,
new types of programs. And we're sitting there in a program now on the paper, you know, for our journalism and our graphic design that's behind the times. And we could be taking this extra money that in fact may very well be there, not only paying the people that, you know, should get some sort of a stipend, but we could also be, you know, buying new equipment. We could be buying new software. We could be having a more up-to-date program so that instead of people graduating and getting out in the world and going, I don't know how to do this because my degree at Morgan State never taught me how to do this, they can say, I'm ready, I'm prepared, and I can take this on. And I think the budget and the censorship and really the student body coming together as a unified body and not being so cliquish, so to speak, is very important.
Can I say something?
Sure, then we're going to open the phones right after that.
Okay. One thing I think that the Promethean and the Spokesman.
Promethean is the yearbook, correct?
Promethean is the yearbook.
That's what
Spokesman's
I thought. So make sure
paper,
I had it right. Yeah.
That, you know, under our, we have a constitution that is approved by the Board of Regents, and the Promethean and the Spokesman is underneath my constitution. Therefore, I approve their budget with printing. We only pay for their printing. Any other knit-nets like program, he was saying, Ms. Brown in past years would usually get sponsors to get that through, or maybe approval of the SJA president to give a little extra money for that. I think we've lost that. I don't think over here in the department, because we're so far away. They're here in the communication building. We're here in the student center. And the Promethean, the Spokesman, are underneath the same constitution. Mm-hmm. And some people have not attended meetings in past years. The editor-in-chief of Spokesman and Promethean are supposed to attend meetings. And I think that's where we lost that connection. So that's what it seems like. It's two different organizations, but actually it's one. Mm-hmm.
Let me open the phones. I do have other questions. We're joined by students here at Morgan State University, the editor-in-chief of the Spokesman, the president and vice president of the student government, and a writer, sports editor, and producer here on campus. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And let us go to the phones. And Larry in South Baltimore, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mr. Stein.
Hi, Larry. Welcome.
You know it's rare that I even call these shows anymore, but these students have been grossly misunderstated, grossly and unjustly. It's an injustice what has happened to them, and overall what's going to happen not only to the media print but this radio station. I'm hearing all over the country, African Student Alliance, that's what they're really called, which started up in our time, 1988. There's going to be a response that this campus is never going to see. So the state police and everybody else, from a public perspective, we already all know this. We're going to come on Hillen Road when it's time. You understand? We're going to support these people. I have relatives who have graduated from these universities. And this kind of unfair and just and mischaracter of media is going to stop. You know, you say you want your people to support black media, black radio. No, we already know what the joke is, man, and we will be there to support them.
All right, Larry.
And that's a given.
Thank you for your call. Any thoughts? Then we'll go back to phones.
Well, Larry, I just want to say thank you very much for the support. I'm a Morganite. I graduated in 2009 this past semester, and I'll be going to Morgan for graduate school. I'm very proud to represent in all circles, within Morgan and outside of Morgan, who we truly are. And I'm not doing this, we're not doing this to try to bring negative attention to Morgan. We're trying to bring positive attention. And what these young ladies with the SGA, what I'm trying to do with the Insider, and what Kevin is trying to do with the Spokesman, is to try to bring positive light and try to bring positive ideas, not only to the Spokesman at Morgan State University, but also outside of the university as well. So I really appreciate that support.
410-319-8888, Ron in Washington, D.C., you're on the air.
Yes, I have a question for the panel.
Mm-hmm.
I'd just like to find out, if it's within the school discretion to hire and fire whomever they please without input from the student government. And I'll just feel offline for my answer.
You raised a very important question. Melissa and I have discussed, we've actually already written a memo demanding that certain university personnel and administrators be present, along with the editor-in-chief of the Spokesman, the editor-in-chief of the Promethean, because we would like to know why Ms. Brown was dismissed from the Spokesman without our they didn't consult us, or they didn't come and talk to us or ask us how we felt about the decision that we made, and we think that's very important. Unfortunately, I will say that a lot of administrators on campus, they don't respect the student government's authority. It's very unfortunate, mainly because in past years, student government administrations haven't demanded that they do respect the authority. So Melissa and I, we have already set up a meeting with them to just ask why this happened. But one thing that Melissa and I, we have to stress is that we're here for the students. Unfortunately, yes, we appreciate all the work that Ms. Brown has done, but we're really here to defend the students of Morgan State University. Now, if the university has released a statement saying that They did not renew her contract because of personnel issues. Unfortunately, Melissa and I don't have the right to, you know, push them about that because she's not a student. So I think that's also an important issue.
Let me go back to the phones. It's okay with y'all. 410-319-8888. As we talk here with student leaders at Morgan State University, and Zaina in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon.
Hi, Zaina.
Good afternoon.
Hello. I actually used to write for the Spokesman newspaper for a couple of years, and I think that the big idea here, or more than the minor things that people seem to be pointing out, is the censorship. Mm-hmm. Our newspaper is going to be censored, and when you have a paper that's censored, it really does take away from the voice of the students. And so my question is directed towards Kevin, the editor-in-chief. How difficult is it going to be to run the paper, considering that it's going to be censored in the coming semesters?
It's going to definitely be a challenge, but I think it can definitely be handled. The biggest thing is that now this thing has really become a much bigger, quote unquote, monster than, I mean, what it was at the beginning of the summer, in the sense that we have media coverage on this now. We have legal representation getting ready to take this to a whole nother level. So, you know, even though we'll be battling the censorship, I still believe it'll be something that we'll be able to overcome quite easily because of the fact that basically they'll be so focused on the legal matters at hand, we'll be able to pretty much function.
I think that one thing the students need to realize who are writing for the Spokesman is that an advisor advises. They don't tell you what to put in and what to not
put in.
They advise.
Right.
So don't be afraid to say what you have to say. Exactly. Those articles came out in February 18th because they said what they wanted to say.
Exactly.
That's what the Spokesman's all about.
No, but I want to be very clear what you all were saying. I mean, are you saying that from your perspective, the university is actively censoring articles that you were telling you cannot write this?
I believe that they are at a place where they're getting ready to move into that. One of the evidences of that is in the fact that there is a battle or talk going on right now about trying to move us from underneath the organizational umbrella and the constitution of the SGA into an actual department under, like, part of maybe the English or the communications department. And if that was done, in effect, it would remove the need for my position or the Promethean editor-in-chief position, because you would have to have a departmental chair, and basically, and then at that point, everything would have to be signed off that would leave the department by the departmental chair, which would be a Morgan State University staff member.
Do you know how it is run, let's say at Towson University or University of Maryland Eastern Shore or Hopkins, how student papers are run there, how they, who they respond to and how they are managed?
I know
that. Do you talk to your peers about that?
Yeah, I know at Towson, I've spoken to the editor-in-chief there several times, and they basically have, you know, the open policy of, you know, the students are able to write, you know, within a, you know, respectable, I'll say, kind of nature, whatever they so choose. And they pretty much, they don't have to answer to the administration. It's not like the administration comes down and checks everything before they send it out. They basically, you know, have that freedom of press, which is what I think we're basically pushing for here.
When I was at the University of Missouri, Columbia, they had two newspapers, and it was a different setup. They had an independent newspaper, which was run by the, like, student affairs. It was called the Maneater, and it was an independent paper. Then they had the newspaper that was run through the journalism school, and they had an NBC affiliate. They had their newspaper called the Columbia Missourian, which only, it was run by the department. But it was more, they had professionals, and then they also had students that were in the journalism program writing for those papers within that. But as far as with other universities here, University of Maryland, College Park, or Towson, that's something that we need to really look into, is how their particular universities run their newspapers, or what the situation is with that.
Let me go back to the phones. Folks calling in here, 410-319-8888. We're talking about the controversies here on Morgan State University's campus around student government and the paper. Love to have you join us here by email, steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to Facebook, and we'll check out what you're writing there as well. 410-319-8888. In the studio now with us, Orion Marshall, Melissa Longley, Jasmine Curry, and Kevin Smith. And who's next here? Walt in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Walt.
I called the radio when you were talking about putting the B back in HBCU. Mm-hmm. I see more talking about newspapers, but I just wanted to say I am a grad student right now, Morgan, but I attended undergraduate Shaw University in North Carolina. As far as, you know, like knowing the history, we had a one semester course everybody was required to take once a week. So I guess 16 classes where we learned about the history of Shaw. And Shaw is like the oldest black school, oldest HBCU in the South. So I don't know if Morgan has that for the undergraduates as far as learning about history or whatnot, but I think that might be something to suggest for future students.
Well, we have orientation,
Melissa.
But when I was a freshman and I was I attended orientation class, it didn't really tell me everything about Morgan. Mm-hmm. It was like the basic. Oh, mm-hmm. Frederick Douglass, mm-hmm. and that's really it.
1867,
right?
The changes in college to university and the state college and things like that, but
nothing extent where I can say, man, I am proud of Morgan, but you ask some students on the campus walking by, they don't know, and that's a problem that we have.
I think the one thing that we do have, though, and it's not necessarily in Gabas and Morgan, but we do have a African diaspora or African, I guess it's a history type three-credit mm-hmm. class that you have to take, I believe, as a general requirement in order mm-hmm. to graduate. And that more or less covers African-American history as a whole. But I would think that they should maybe do a little more concerning Morgan as a university itself, either in the orientation process or even in that class, maybe. That's definitely a valid point.
To me, it just seems clear that Morgan is just moving further and further away from being a traditionally historically black
yeah.
college. When you visit other campuses, you know, there are things like, and this may sound cliche, but there are things like Greek plots and just things that just remind me of TV shows like A Different World and such. It just reminds me. But I think we have so many nice new buildings now, and we have, you know, a lot better facilities. I think a lot of times, you know, it doesn't look like a HBCU sometimes. It doesn't feel like a HBCU.
We're getting too bougie.
Yeah.
Yes, way too bougie. So Where are Greek benches at? That's
yeah,
what I
it's just
know.
A lot. It's just a lot of so, other things. So.
Before we go back to the phones, I want to get back to some of these calls coming in. But I really want to, and we only have, like, I think I have 5 or 6 minutes left in this conversation, but I really want to get a handle on what it is you change. Mm. What is it you would make different here? What do you want? I mean, what is it you want to see that is not happening at this moment that you firmly believe should happen?
Transparency.
Transparency, yes.
In what?
In how you deal. Administration. Where does our money go? When we pay,
you mean like your budget for the spokesman, your budget right, for the SGA, is that what
right.
you're
talking about? And not even that, but even on a greater level to a personal level. I know a lot of colleges, when you pay your tuition and your fees, there's a breakdown of where those things go that you can see. And to my knowledge, there's nothing that is printed on a yearly basis or annual basis that says, not just for the organizations, but for students in general. I mean, I would love to be able to log onto my websites and say, hey, you know, okay, this is where my fees are going. This is where my tuition is going. Because when you get to a place where, you know, you don't have, you know, newer equipment, or even in cases where, you know, through our tuition and fees, we're supposed to have ability to use different equipment on campus, the track, things like that. And then there's issues with using the track, things like that. I mean, just it's like, where's the breakdown of our tuition and fees? What are we really paying for to go here? And then on the organizational level, beyond what it costs to run the organization, what do we have left, if anything, to buy new equipment or to pay some positions or to...
And you think you, the students, should control that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to get clear, mm-hmm. that you think you should control that.
There should be a better process also as to how monies are transferred. It should be maybe more signatures involved and more people involved, to the point of where there is more transparency and it's not just one individual signing off on something that happens, but it's maybe 4 or 5 signatures. And although in talking to Mr. Ricardo Perry, who is the director,
Vice President
of Student Affairs, he said that one of the good things that came out of this situation was that they were going to make some changes in the way that things were dispersed now on campus as far as finances. We have yet to hear anything or see anything more of that And that's what we would really like to see, I think. And as well as that, the last thing I would like to see is, and it's happening today now, is for the SGA and the spokesman, and I'm committed to doing this on my half in the coming year as the editor-in-chief, for us to come together and be more unified and not be so against each other. And that's really what's going to get us, you know, the ultimate victory, I think, in this, is that now by the SGA supporting us, the university no longer has a foothold to stand on as far as with the students, because now they don't have the SGA.
Well, we have a few minutes left. I'm going to try to get another caller in here, at least one or two. And okay. Marshall, we haven't heard from you in the last 5 or 6 minutes, which I know is probably unusual for you. But so feel free to jump in here.
Okay. Kevin was doing such a great job of speaking, so I wanted to.
I'm sorry.
No, it's good.
410-319-8888. Mary, on your cell, you're on the air.
Car.
Okay.
I just wanted to let you know that I work for Johns Hopkins University for an institute that the Institute for Nanobiotechnology, and we have had 2 summer scholars from Oregon State University. I believe both of them were in the Department of Biology. They spent 10 weeks conducting research. We had a young woman and a young man, and the young woman worked in a chemical and biomolecular engineering laboratory. The other one worked in a, I think it was a mechanical engineering, biomedical engineering laboratory working with tissue engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, this program is a highly competitive, very academically rigorous summer program where they conduct a 10-week research project, and at the end of that, we did a poster session with all of the other students on Hopkins campus, and these students were not only exemplary scholars, they were just wonderful people to work with. They were, both of their mentors were incredibly impressed with them. And, you know, we run this program because we do it for undergraduates so that they will be enticed to apply to Hopkins to earn PhDs. But I also hope that, so we hope that they go back to Morgan and talk about their experience there, because I think they're both going to be seniors, or they maybe are getting ready to graduate. And but they were also, they were ambassadors for Morgan State University on the Johns Hopkins campus, because people who worked with them, who encountered them, the faculty members they worked with were highly impressed with their skills, with their knowledge level. They had really high GPAs, and they were very skilled in what they did in their labs. So all I can say is that whatever they're doing over there, at least in the sciences, from what I've been able to run into, has been really excellent. And we hope to continue to admit students from Morgan in the sciences into our nanobiotechnology summer research undergraduate experience.
We're almost out of time. I do appreciate that call. I think it buoys everybody's spirits here on campus. People say that about Morgan State University students, and it's I'm not surprised to hear that. So let's kind of wrap this up. We only have about a minute left until our next segment, and Marshall, why don't you close us out with your final 60-second thought here?
Well, what I'm going to say is that it's important for administration to talk to the students. And if there's some sort of remuneration that we can get, is to at least try to talk to the students. The biggest reason why a lot of this got to where it is because of the administration's seem like unwillingness to be able to share any kind of discourse or any kind of dialogue. I'm going to stop short of asking for Ms. Brown's job back, because I think that she was a phenomenal person, not the out of control employee that was painted in the Baltimore Sun, but somebody that was about the students. And we need more teachers and professors that are about the students, advisors are about the students, because 70% of Morgan's employees are contractual, and it's hard to get that base when you have that.
I do appreciate all of you taking the time to come to WEA and talk about the situation from your perspective.
Thank you.
Ryan Marshall, Melissa Longley, Jasmine Curry, Kevin Smith, it's been a pleasure to meet you all. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you as well.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland, Marlene and Stuart Greenebaum Cancer Center, an NCI-designated cancer center providing research, treatment, and education to further the prevention and cure for cancer. Online at www.umgcc.org, or the number for information is 1-800-888-8823. And when we return, we'll be talking with Chris Bean from Slate, talking about health care for the undocumented. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. And now, our interview with Chris Beam from Slate Magazine. This is Mark Steiner. We're about to have a conversation with Christopher Beam, who is a Slate political reporter. You can also follow him on Twitter, which means you can also read him over at slate.com. He's written a piece called Salud Amigo, The Economic Case for Insuring Undocumented Immigrants, not the most popular cause in America. And Christopher Beam, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And it is not the most popular idea in America for most people.
No, hardly. It may even rank among the most unpopular.
Yes, I would think so. So let's talk about this, though, because President Obama, as you point out in your second paragraph, was quoted as saying, reiterated last Thursday from when you wrote this article, quote, undocumented workers who are here illegally, we want to create comprehensive immigration reform so they can get a path to citizenship. Until they do, we can't reward them with some of the benefits, which quite frankly cost us a lot of money. So he's laid down the gauntlet saying no.
Right. And this was in response to accusations that his plan for health care reform would ensure undocumented immigrants, which is almost entirely untrue. And so he was just making clear that, you know, in fact, it does not include undocumented immigrants. And essentially, because if it did, that would be a poison pill for the bill. I don't think any congressman would want to be on record insuring undocumented immigrants. The health care reform issue is controversial enough as it is. They don't need to get the immigration reform issue involved as well.
But you've leapt into the fray with this piece that you wrote. Clearly, you think that there's something here that we need to wrestle with.
Right. Well, for starters, I should recognize the political reality and say that there are very few members of Congress who would support insuring undocumented immigrants. But I think if you take the president at his word, and if you look at the economic argument he's making for health care reform, I think it's hard to say that we shouldn't be insuring undocumented immigrants using the logic that he uses. And here's what I mean by that. Barack Obama's defense of health care reform is that it's going to save money for us in the long run, and that by bringing uninsured people into the system, by insuring them, we will be able to prevent them from getting sick rather than having them show up at the emergency room sick already, and we have to then treat them by law, by federal law, in what's essentially the most inefficient way possible, having them get in line and treating them in what's often an emergency situation. His argument is that it's much better to use prevention to catch diseases on the front end, and basically, in the end, we will save money doing that. And my point is that if you're going to make that argument about the uninsured in general, it makes no sense to rule out undocumented immigrants, because if the uninsured are a burden on emergency rooms and the healthcare system, so then are undocumented immigrants, and insuring them would save money as well.
Now, you also, though you don't write about extensively in your article, there's a link you have in your article on Slate.com where not everyone agrees, you say. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's saying that not everyone agrees that prevention, in the end, is going to save a lot of money. People will say, yes, it will keep people from getting sick. It will probably end up... I think you can make the moral case for prevention, but on the other hand, it means that people will go to the doctor more, and it means they will get more tests screening whether they have cancer or other diseases. And all those things cost money. So there's a big debate going on right now over whether prevention itself saves money. But the president has sided with the people who say that it is going to save money. And the OMB, Peter Orszag agrees, and it's been a major part of their case in pushing healthcare reform. So I think if you look at the economic argument that they have been making, you can disagree with it, mm-hmm. but if you take it for what it is, then it doesn't make a lot of sense not to extend that to undocumented immigrants.
It reminds me of a story. By the way, we're talking with Christopher Beam, who wrote Salud Amigo at Slate.com. He's a political reporter for Slate.com, for Slate. And this is about the economic case for insuring undocumented immigrants. And it reminds me of when I went to see the doctor recently, and he's the ENT specialist, and saw this man that turned out to be from Mexico who spoke very little English. He said, I don't know whether he was legal or illegal, but he had this condition in his mouth that was cancerous that had to be dealt with. And whether he was, as he said, documented, undocumented, whether he had money or not, I had to make sure he was taken care of. And gave him, and convinced another specialist to see him and put him into a local hospital here in Baltimore to take care of him. And that, of course, was a six-figure treatment they were giving this man with no insurance. And though every undocumented worker is not going to have a cancer to deal with, that's the kind of thing that gets, those are the kind of things that begin to really burden a medical system in a very severe way.
Right. It all adds up, and I think that the numbers right now are still murky. The Congressional Budget Office, in its estimates, they don't score the effect that insuring undocumented immigrants would have. So in the end, we actually don't really know how much it would cost or save. All we know is that the logic undergirding this entire reform would suggest that it would save money. I know you can also make this whole time we've been talking about the economic case. I think you can also talk about the moral case if you want to. Something that I didn't know before I started researching this article is that the IRS and the Social Security Administration estimate that 3/4 of undocumented immigrants pay taxes that go towards Social Security and Medicare,
mm-hmm.
And that's a lot. And so, if you're going to believe that and say that they're contributing money towards this, then wouldn't it make sense then that they would benefit from the spending?
That's it. So that would be 3/4 of the one research group estimate of 11 million people in this country being undocumented workers.
Yeah, and it's unclear exactly what portion of the uninsured undocumented immigrants makes up. I've seen it as high as half. I've seen it as low as 20%. But it's a pretty significant chunk of that 47 million that Obama's always talking about. So if you're going to rule out, between 20 and 50% of that huge number, that's a pretty significant amount, a number of people to be ignoring.
Well, you're right in here that the Employee Benefit Research Association estimated that insuring undocumented immigrants would save about $11 billion a year in the long run. And they're assuming 6 million uninsured undocumented immigrants, as opposed to another estimate, which is 11 million, which could at least by half or double that number, that 11
right.
billion.
Right. And they, when they provided that number, were very clear that it was an estimate and just a very ballpark estimate based on how much it costs per person per year to provide emergency room treatment. So it's basically looking at the cost overall of people just showing up uninsured to the emergency room and imagining what amount of that comes from undocumented immigrants. So as you can see, $11 billion, that's not a huge amount of money in the long run. That's not a huge amount of savings. So in the end, we're really talking about money on the margins, which is why I think the moral case does end up playing a part, because you can't say that insuring undocumented immigrants is going to suddenly make healthcare reform affordable for the entire country.
Yeah, I wonder how you balance it in terms of even if it existed, how you, as you allude to in your article, how undocumented workers would respond to even coming into a hospital or signing up for healthcare. as you put it, because they could bring ICE knocking at their doors. I mean, here in Baltimore, Maryland, we had a situation. We had an interview with a police major who runs a district which is the largest growing segment of the population are Latinos from Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala. A good portion of them, 60% or more, are undocumented, at least that number, if not more. And that when they go into a dispute, they don't talk to ICE. I mean, they don't, unless
they're
broken a law.
Right, they want to stay as far away as possible.
Right.
And that's a major concern if you're going to bring them into the healthcare system. You know, any situation where they're going to have to be talking to employees of the government, and there's a possibility that one of them is going to be an immigration official, I think would disturb them. The counterargument is that there's right now a lot of a lot of costs that go into screening to make sure that an immigrant is eligible to get health care. And so if you were insuring all immigrants instead of just documented immigrants, you could presumably eliminate a lot of that bureaucracy and red tape surrounding confirming their eligibility.
So is there anyone on Capitol Hill who supports this idea of ensuring undocumented workers and how it would help?
I could not find a single one.
Not a single one.
And the only group that came out and told me that they were unequivocally for it was the National Council for La Raza,
mm-hmm.
A Hispanic group. You know, even the groups out there that we generally consider liberal on the left, they don't support including undocumented immigrants. If anything, they would prefer to keep immigration reform and healthcare reform separate.
It's one of those issues that hits so deeply in the political viscera of the American population, it's hard to have a logical conversation about it.
Yeah, exactly. And so I thought it was worth just tossing out there and pointing out some of the logical inconsistencies here while recognizing that, you know, in an ideal world, this would be the case. In this world, it's not, and it probably won't be for quite a while.
Unless it becomes part of, somehow becomes part of the impetus for a separate, different immigration policy that is pushed by the Obama White House.
Right. And for the moment, it seems like Obama has tabled immigration reform just because
he's got enough on his plate.
There's healthcare reform, yeah, exactly. Cap and trade, and so much even coming up after the August break. I'd be very surprised if we tackle immigration reform this year. But you're right, I wouldn't be surprised if this came up again when immigration is being debated. But as you said, it's so sensitive, and there's so many emotions tangled up in there that I think if they're trying to get a palatable version of immigration reform, I don't think it's going to include health care for all.
Well, Christopher Beam, I appreciate you being one of those people who brings these issues up for us to kind of wrestle with and think about whether we want to or not.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Great to talk to you. Christopher Beam wrote the article Salud Amigo. It's Slate. You can go to slate.com to read it. You can just go to our website, steinershow.org, and link to that as well. And he'll even see him on Twitter. Thanks again, Christopher.